This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. Never in the century has a vote for a court nominee been so close or left the country so divided. Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment were handled by the Senate Judiciary Committee differently than they would have been in a court of law. We were curious about those differences. David Carries is a Temple University law professor and editor of the book The Politics of Law. In his 20 years as a civil liberties lawyer, he has litigated cases involving sexual and racial harassment. Last year, Carries won an out-of-court settlement against the FBI in the Bureau's first case involving racial harassment. Carries says that although there are laws against sexual and racial harassment, and we as a society agree harassment is wrong, we don't necessarily understand the predicament of the complainant.
We as a culture have a lot of expectations about victims and about heroes. To me, for instance, Rosa Parks is a hero of the civil rights movement. Anita Hill is a victim who then showed heroic courage, I think, in coming forward and doing what she did. But victims are picked by other people or by chance. They happen to be in a certain place at a certain time. Something happens to them. It is very unfair, I think, and not very human in terms of expectations to expect a victim to, first of all, make all the decisions in her life as if raising a certain public issue is the only thing that's important.
What questions were you anxious to ask her that you didn't hear asked during the hearings?
The questions about concrete decisions, not on a big scale, not like, why didn't you report it? What did you see as your choices at the point where he first harassed you? What did you see as your choices, and why did you make the decision you made as we go down the line? Now she goes to the EEOC. Her connection to power and to these good jobs is Clarence Thomas. And she faces the same thing. She can try and move on when it starts up. She said it stopped for a long time, even prior to the move, and that's why she felt okay about going with him. She had no place else to go. And she again is in this situation where she could sacrifice that job if she reports it, probably not win, or go somewhere else. She gets a connection to Oral Roberts Law School. Now, this is really, to be honest, about the bottom of the heap as law schools go. Law teaching is very difficult to break into. She's made the connection through Clarence Thomas. To expect her at that point, when someone talks about Clarence Thomas at Oral Roberts Law School, and when the dean, as we heard in such elaborate detail, is in the process of writing a book basically saying that Clarence Thomas should be sainted, is she going to do we expect her, is really the question, to talk negatively about him? No. It would make no sense. It would also be embarrassing to say he harassed me then, but I didn't complain.
Let's talk about Clarence Thomas. The senators were trying to establish his credibility or lack of credibility. Clarence Thomas's approach was to just deny all the charges and to offer very little or virtually no information about himself beyond his denials. What questions might you have asked to get beyond those denials into more information?
All right. First, I would want to clarify exactly what his position was with regard to whether sexual harassment was a legitimate subject of inquiry. And I would have thought the senators would push him because his basic position seemed to be, and the position of the administration seemed to be, that even a credible allegation of sex harassment should simply be disregarded if it's made about a prominent man. This is a negation of the whole law of sex harassment. Itself could provide a basis for saying the man shouldn't sit on the Supreme Court.
What questions might you have asked to establish his credibility or his lack of credibility?
Okay. When you get to the basic problem that I think everybody watching these proceedings had, that they both seemed credible, the tendency of the 14 white male senators was to look to Anita Hill and say, can we find some psychological explanation why her story might not be true? And they asked numerous witnesses to speculate who had no basis at all about her perhaps being out of touch with reality. Instead, if you look at the record they had before them, I'm talking about the record of the previous confirmation hearings as well as the sex harassment, there was a clear pattern of denial and evasion of clearly established facts by Clarence Thomas. He was, for many years, one of the primary spokespeople for the far right. There's no question about that. There's piles of speeches that the senators had in front of them. He managed to make to take a kind of a grand denial strategy. And there's a question of whether you view this as a psychological, part of his psychological makeup, his personality, or if one prefers a less psychological explanation, it's just the strategy that he and the spin doctors at the White House came up with. In either event, really, or it could be both, what he did was to basically deny the essential fact that he had taken these positions. He would not and was not pushed by the Democratic senators clarify whether his position was actually different. In other words, when he praised Lewis Lehrman's speech, he should have been pushed, do you agree with Lewis Lehrman's speech? Do you disagree? If you've changed since then, why have you changed, etc.? In the situation about abortion, the man not only denied having a position or taking any formal position, he denied ever discussing it with anyone. This is a grand denial. This is an evasion. This is a failure to deal with reality, if one wishes to look at it in the same terms that it seemed to be pressed on Anita Hill. These could have been developed, I think, quite easily.
Some people said that Anita Hill seemed too controlled and too unemotional to be credible. I wonder what your reaction was to that. And when you've defended people who charged sexual harassment, what did you tell them about how emotional to be on the stand?
It's a very difficult issue. Part of it has to do with the expectations in our culture about victims. We expect victims to be extremely and eternally suffering. They are supposed to exude suffering and pain. Now, the reality is when people get hurt, even if when they get hurt very seriously, either physically or psychologically or both, there are mechanisms of healing. You do find ways to go on with the rest of your life, and hopefully the people close to you help you do that. The people around you encourage you to do that. So what happens is whatever the mechanisms are, and they're different for different people, you can block parts of it. You can repress, depending if you tend to a Freudian explanation. But you lose the immediacy and the direct consciousness with that immense pain, as you must to function in the rest of your life. It's like people who have lost a loved one. So that one has to call it up, and one has to decide whether to call it up. Now, this is one of the difficult problems in any kind of harassment case, whether it's sexual or racial or anything like that, or to some extent in any kind of victim case. You, as the lawyer in my position, have to encourage the client not to exaggerate or not to cry on demand. That's not the problem. The problem that the person will feel is, if I call this up, if I let this out, I can't control it. I have learned how to control it. I have fought hard. The tears still come once in a while, but I basically can function. So you have to say to the person, you have to let it out in order to show the onlookers, to some extent, it's their expectation. But to have to do that, particularly in a case where she never decided to go ahead with this, I mean, it was really, she was quite reluctant all the way. And there she is thrust not only in front of a court and a jury, but in front of the entire nation and expected to basically act hysterical, is one way you could think of it, to tap in to the pain that she felt.
Anita Hill said that Clarence Thomas would talk to her about pornography and Long Dong Silver. Would, as a civil liberties lawyer, who I'm sure you believe that what somebody watches in the privacy of their own home is their own business.
Certainly.
Would you have brought up with Clarence Thomas, if you were questioning him, if he in fact watched a lot of pornography? Or would you have not brought that up, thinking that's just not really relevant, that's a private issue?
I would have attempted to draw a line between whether he watched anything, which I think is perfectly his business and has nothing to do with his qualifications to be a Supreme Court justice, and what pornography or other matters of a potentially offensive nature he imposed on others. But I certainly would not be letting up on what he imposed on others. The summaries, which was not merely towards Anita Hill, there was other evidence in the record about it that the Democrats were too afraid to touch.
But you would not have questioned him about if he goes to the video store and rents pornography, if he used to enjoy pornography in college. You wouldn't have gotten
into personally that. Wouldn't have. There are others, I'd have to say, who also have similar litigation experience to me who you might get a different answer from.
My guest is civil liberties lawyer David Carries. He's a law professor at Temple University. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Civil liberties lawyer David Carries is my guest. You used to head up something called the Jury Selection Project, and I know you've given a lot of thought to how to select a fair jury. What went through your mind when you saw people who are involved in partisan politics being the jury for a sexual harassment case, which is what part of this boiled down to?
Yes. Well, I have worked with a group called the National Jury Project, which is still functioning quite well. And, of course, the prospect of trying a sex harassment case to 14 middle-aged or upper-aged white males is quite difficult. It seems to me that the Democrats, and this I lodge at them, should have realized that they were somewhat out of their element here. They also had some particular personal problems that made it difficult for them to take an active role. And this would have led me to think that they should, first of all, consult someone who knows about sex harassment cases. So you know that there's going to be a blaming the victim strategy. It always emerges in defense of the man charged with sex harassment. You have to be ready to deal with that. You have to have somebody who can both defend the victim, Anita Hill, and with due respect, but in a very straightforward and somewhat aggressive manner, force Clarence Thomas to answer the relevant questions.
The charges of sexual harassment were heard before the Senate Judiciary Committee, not a court of law. And there's a difference between how a Senate committee and a court will handle the charges. Many senators brought up the issue of who had the burden of proof, and what a lot of the senators were saying was Clarence Thomas should be innocent until proven guilty. And if there's a shadow of a doubt about his guilt, then he is innocent and he should be confirmed. Since this was not a court of law, but a Senate committee, I was wondering, as a lawyer who works in a court of law, what you thought about, innocence and guilt, and who had the burden of proof and so on.
Well, we're not talking about a crime. So to think in terms of reasonable doubt makes no sense. This was really a proceeding where the issue is one's fitness to the Supreme Court. And the question of whether to affirm or not affirm is the question.
In a sexual harassment case in a court of law, if there is a shadow of a doubt about the guilt of the party charged with sexual harassment, then they'd be innocent, yes?
Well, it depends if it's amounting to a crime. These cases usually aren't criminal cases. Usually the person making the allegations would have to prove by what's called a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but basically to prove it's more likely than not that it occurred. That's the most burden that I could imagine fairly being appropriate to this case. But the question that was relevant for them is, should Clarence Thomas be confirmed as a justice of the Supreme Court? If they come to believe at any point in the proceedings and after it's over, weighing all of the evidence they heard and putting aside any irrelevant considerations in their mind, they believe that he engaged in sex harassment of this serious a nature, I think they should vote against confirmation.
Anita Hill said that she was sexually harassed. Clarence Thomas said that he was being lynched for being an uppity black. As a white man who has who has worked with people who have filed sexual harassment suits and racial discrimination suits, how did you weigh those charges of sexual harassment and racial discrimination?
There's a very popular Black Studies book that's used in women's Black Studies courses. And the title is, All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave. What it says, and I think it's quite poignant, we as a society view sex discrimination as a problem that focuses on white women. We view race discrimination as a problem that focuses on black men. Where does this leave black women?
I believe the Supreme Court has a sexual harassment case coming up very soon. Do you think that Judge Thomas should exempt himself from this case?
No. No, I think one's experience and one's life, he doesn't have a pending charge against him. He doesn't, he's not involved, I don't think, in that particular case. Then that wouldn't, I don't think that would be required.
What do you mean he's not involved in that case?
I mean, he has no particular connection to that case. If he once served as a lawyer or if it came through the EEOC, I don't know. If it came through the EEOC when he was there, that could result in him recusing himself. But it too much gets used in that idea in a very general way that I think is very illegitimate. For instance, I've seen white lawyers move to disqualify a black judge from hearing a race discrimination case. The theory, presumably, is he might know too much. no, I don't think that would be appropriate. There's one on this this issue of black women. There is a history there that really does get too little attention. One example of it, in the early 1900s, it used to be extremely relevant in rape prosecutions whether the woman was chaste. This was the legal term.
That chaste was with an E?
Chaste with an E. Exactly. Chastity.
Chastity, yes.
Chastity was a relevant concern, the presumption being that if a woman had slept with someone, then she wasn't raped by the person who's charged with raping her. A ridiculous assumption, of course. But there was a presumption as to white women in the law that they were chaste. And so to the extent it became relevant in a trial, the other side had to try and prove the lack of chastity of a white woman. Fairly regularly in American courts, that presumption was not extended to black women.
Do you think that the process of confirming a Supreme Court justice should be reformed?
Well, this is the difficulty. We are different than even the other Western democracies, which are culturally similar to us, in the way we regard law. Law takes over such a broad range of disputes and controversies in our society, and to me, and to a large extent, replaces politics. It's one of the reasons that we have such a low level, in my mind, of political discourse, and such low interest among the people in political issues and even in electoral issues. So what we've done is turn over virtually everything to the courts. And if we're going to do that, it seems to me that we have every right to inquire in detail, particularly about their approaches, not necessarily about more aspects of their personal life, although I think sexual harassment is certainly a relevant and pertinent question. I think they are up there on that court applying values. And if we're going to turn over all these decisions to them, we need to know those values. And I would think any justice or nominated justice who won't answer such questions, such as the last two, I think should be voted no just on that ground.
What about the process itself? Would you like to see the process changed? Or do you think the process works okay?
Well, there was something very ugly about this second batch of hearings. There's no question. On the other hand, sex harassment is ugly. And any proceeding about it is ugly. Even those conducted pursuant to the rules of evidence in a court of law, there would be some difference. Senator Spector, might get laughed at for some of his questions about FBI reports or his claim of perjury. He might get lectured by the judge because it was preposterous. He couldn't say those things in front of a jury. Senator Hatch couldn't quote from The Exorcist. So there was a little bit of extra theatrics. But the basic point and the basic ugliness of it, I have to say, would not be much different.
Why wouldn't Senator Hatch have been allowed to introduce The Exorcist and the quote about the pubic hair in the gin if it were a court of law instead of a Senate Judiciary Committee?
You'd have to show some connection. It would be prejudicial. You'd have to show that she read it, that it had some connection to the case. As I understand it, in that instance, Professor Catherine McKinnon, who's a law professor who's written a lot about sex harassment, had done really some very important work, submitted an affidavit late in the process saying that the story about the Coke can and the pubic hair, I believe, actually comes from a porno film. And that would raise the prospect that Clarence Thomas saw it. So that shifts it as to it helping Anita Hill's credibility and hurting Clarence Thomas's credibility. Well, in both instances, I mean, if you couldn't establish that, say, he had seen that particular film or that she had read The Exorcist, it's so speculative that I think most judges would keep it out. And it's potentially damaging.
In your critique of how the senators behaved as lawyers, what are some of the things you thought were out of bounds or cheap tricks?
Well, the cheapest to me was my own senator, Senator Spector, using the word perjury. He's a former prosecutor. He knew quite well, he's a quite bright man, that is totally inappropriate. What Anita Hill had said, she had couched with, "I'm not sure, I'm not really remembering a lot on that issue." It was a side issue. As he asked her more, she said, "Well, I'm remembering a little more about that. There might have been a discussion that had something to do with that." There is no possible way in the world of getting a perjury indictment or conviction on testimony like that, and Arlen Specter knew it.
David Karas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Karas is a civil liberties lawyer and a professor of law at Temple University. He edited the book, The Politics of Law. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.